well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Going to be talking with Stephen Gutowski of The Reload here in just a moment. Generally, about open carry, specifically, I guess, whether or not open carry is the only form of bearing arms that is actually protected by the Constitution. It's an interesting argument. And of course, you know, this is, I guess, an argument that has extra weight right now, given what's going on in Florida, where the First District Court of Appeals recently ruled that Florida's ban on open carry is unconstitutional, violates the Second Amendment. Now, that was not a decision by the Florida Supreme Court, but Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer, you know, recently declined to defend Florida's ban on gun sales to adults under the age of 21 before the Supreme Court. He submitted a brief telling the court, I'm not going to defend this law in NRA versus Glass. Uthmeyer came out with an advisory opinion, I think it was yesterday, that because the Florida Supreme Court has not considered, about 10 years ago, Florida Supreme Court held that Florida's ban on open carry was actually fine, was constitutionally valid. But Uthmeyer says because the Florida Supreme Court has not considered a case in light of Bruin, in light of Rahimi, that essentially that decision is null and void. And that the decision by the First District Court of Appeals does apply statewide. Uthmeyer says he's also not going to challenge the District Court of Appeals decision. So the Florida Supreme Court will not have an opportunity to reconsider whether or not the open carry ban is unconstitutional. So according to the Attorney General, as of right now, or at least as of September 25th, when the court's order is set to take effect, open carry is legal in the state of Florida. So generally, open carry is legal across most of the country, right? I think now that Florida, at least through the courts, has recognized open carry, I believe Illinois and California are the only states that don't allow for open carry. And we'll get into this with Stephen Gutowski because it's been sort of an interesting legal debate really since Heller, but certainly, let's say, over the last, you know, decade or so, and really even in advance of Bruin, you know, are both forms of carry protected by the Constitution? If you allow for one form of carry, can you ban the other form of carry? Obviously, we understand now that the right to bear arms, well, we've always understood this, but even opponents of a right to keep and bear arms understand, however reluctantly, that yes, we can carry a firearm for self-defense. Now the fight is over where we can, how we can, how much the state can charge to exercise that right, things of that nature. So Jake Fogelman over at The Reload has an interesting article about this debate. Is open carry the only form of carry that's actually protected by the Constitution? And again, that doesn't mean that lawmakers can't allow for concealed carry, but is concealed carry actually protected? We'll take that up with Steve Gutowski of The Reload. Take a look and a listen. Steven, thanks very much for coming to the program. It's good to see you, my friend.
Absolutely. Always love coming on.
And sporting ACDC, I figured you'd be wearing Philly stuff today.
That's a good point. I probably should. Like, I got, here we go. My Phillies hat.
Oh, perfect. Right. We don't need to do all that for the whole interview, but congrats. The Red Sox in the third place in the AL East, so maybe we'll make it to the wild card, but I'm not hopeful about that. So
I just want to see Schwarber get 60 home runs. That'd be my grail for the regular season here.
That would be pretty amazing. That'd be amazing. All right, another amazing thing to talk about. Open carry comes to Florida. No thanks to the legislature, particularly the state Senate, right, which is Senate President Ben Albritton has blocked, you know, not just open carry, but a bill that would repeal the ban on gun sales under 21. But there was a court case that's been kicking around, I guess, for a few years, right? McDaniel versus Florida. And the First District Court of Appeals last week said that Florida's ban on open carry violates the Second Amendment. And then yesterday we saw Attorney General James Uthmeyer say not only is he not going to appeal that decision to the Florida Supreme Court, But that because the Florida Supreme Court has not considered a challenge to an open carry ban since Bruin and Rahimi, that basically this decision, this appellate court decision, applies statewide. And so he says open carry is the law of the land throughout the state of Florida. He is encouraging sheriffs, police chiefs, prosecutors not to arrest or prosecute anybody who's openly carrying a firearm.
Yeah, pretty remarkable turn of events there in the Sunshine State. I mean, I wasn't expecting certainly the AG's determination that it applies to the entire state. It is a state case, of course, not a federal case, but it does rely heavily on the Bruin method, the Bruin test. It's a significant win for open carry activists. One you don't see a lot, frankly, in the courts. But probably in large part because most states already have open carry, to be fair. It's, you know, most states have had it since the founding, right? But yeah, a pretty significant move in Florida in particular on this front, where you've seen a lot of activism on open carry and a lot of gun rights activists generally unhappy with the state of Florida's gun laws because they are a bit of an outlier compared to the rest of the Republican controlled states out there. And I think there are some implications from this ruling that I'm sure we'll get into that might not make people as happy, but with the outcome, the actual practical effect, gun rights activists, at least open carry activists, certainly are going to be very happy.
They are, although they are, you know, expressing some concern that the legislature might try to limit or restrict this court's ruling by imposing new conditions on open carry. I hope that doesn't happen. Luis Valdez from Gunners of America, he knows Florida politics way better than I do. But it seems to me like the problem really has been with the Senate leadership not going along with pro-gun bills, not necessarily the House and the Senate passing gun control bills, at least not since Parkland, right, in 2018.
Right.
So hopefully, those concerns are don't come to fruition, I should say. But as you say, I mean, there are some interesting implications here, right? And you've got a piece at the Reload right now. I think did Jake write this, Jake Fogelman?
Yes. Yeah, our contributing writer.
Talking about whether or not open carry is required by the Second Amendment, and even whether or not open carry is the only form of bearing arms that is protected by the Second Amendment, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the implication in this ruling. Obviously, they're just determining whether or not open carry can be restricted and coming down on the side of the idea that it can't because it's protected by the Second Amendment. That's essentially what this court found, the state court found, using the Bruin, the federal test that's been developed by the Supreme Court. They looked at the historical record, which does lean much more towards open carry historically. You know, there's been obviously a cultural shift in America to where most American gun owners and most legislatures prefer concealed carry now. But for a very long time, it was the other way around, where concealed carry was viewed as this court relies on negatively by most states. And most of the bans that existed, now they didn't come until later on as well. So there's, you know, how much this holds water, generally, this is not a without controversy argument, certainly. But most of the restrictions we saw on gun carrying in the, you know, early days of America were on concealed carry, not on open carry. And so the conclusion that this court drew was essentially that open carry is certainly protected and might be the only form of carry that is actually protected under our tradition of gun regulations.
Yeah. Judge Stephanie Ray said, the historical record makes clear that open carry was regarded as the lawful and preferred mode of bearing arms, while concealed carry was viewed as dangerous to public safety and ineffective for self-defense. No historical tradition supports Florida's open carry ban. To the contrary, history confirms that the right to bear arms in public necessarily includes the right to do so openly. And as Fogelman points out, Clarence Thomas and Bruin said that the historical evidence from antebellum America does demonstrate that the manner of public carry was subject to reasonable regulation, saying that states could lawfully eliminate one kind of public carry, concealed carry, so long as they left open the option to carry openly. And that, you know, going back, like even before Bruin, Steve, it seems like that was sort of the consensus among a lot of Second Amendment scholars. Was that right? You could regulate what bearing arms looked like in terms of open or concealed, but you had to allow one or the other. And again, you know, the vast majority of states, we've sort of shifted since the 19th century in terms of what is the preferred practice. Now it is, you know, concealed carry. But I mean, I guess based on even what Clarence Thomas said in Bruin, if a state like California really wanted to mess with the right to bear arms, because I think most people would prefer to carry concealed and not openly, right? Mm-hmm. They could pass a ban on concealed carry and say, no, if you want to carry, you gotta carry it openly. And maybe that would, you know, maybe we would see a smaller number of people choose to exercise the right to bear arms in that regard.
It is possible. I will say, yes, first off, yes, most courts that you've seen and most scholars who talk about this issue, including the Supreme Court, as you read from there, have discussed it in terms of you can pick one or the other. You can restrict some forms of gun carry, but not all forms of gun carry is sort of the conclusion. And that is, in practice, come down to you can ban open carry, but not concealed carry. But presumably the other way around is also logical. And in fact, that is how historically it was done the other way around, where they would ban concealed carry and allow open carry. Now, as you mentioned, most gun owners, not all, obviously, there are still a significant number of open carry activists out there, as this case itself demonstrates. But most gun owners now prefer concealed carry. And most, I think, people in society prefer concealed carry. They don't like to see the gun if people are out in public carrying. And so, yeah, yes, there you could get some sort of 4D chess move in a deep blue state that says, well, okay, we can ban one form of carry. I guess maybe we should try banning the more popular version of it to try and dissuade people. That's certainly, you could see the logic of it. I think it would be difficult to do in practice, just like you could see the logic of a red state passing an assault weapons ban so that they could get a favorable ruling in one of the more conservative districts. But in practice, that's probably never going to happen because it's very difficult to explain that kind of 40 chess move to your constituents. And so in California, they wanted to do this sort of mind trick thing where they're like, okay, we can ban one form, let's ban the popular one. But we have to legalize open carry. I think that the backlash would be too much for sort of a tongue in cheek kind of move like that. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. So there's more of a political constraint to it. Also, you know, I don't know how well that would go over at the Supreme Court. We have Thomas's words there, but obviously the predominant form of carry now is concealed carry, and I wonder if that would factor in at all. Perhaps shouldn't for how the analysis is supposed to be done, but the Supreme Court is also a political body to a certain extent in these matters.
Yeah.
But I just think the main thing that would keep something from like that from happening is it'd be very difficult for a Democratic politician in a deep blue state to explain why they want to legalize open carry, right?
I don't think it would be that difficult if they justified it again by, you know, banning concealed carry. But I think that they would run into a problem politically, even in a state like California, because, you know, there are Democrats who carry, right? There are plenty of Democrats in California who have their concealed carry license who don't want to openly carry.
Right.
And, you know, for the most part, anti-gun politicians still couch their opposition to our Second Amendment by saying they don't oppose the Second Amendment, right? They're just in favor of common sense gun safety regulations. So it would be hard for them to do that while they are intentionally, again, you know, making it impossible to carry in the preferred method for most Americans. But
yeah.
I mean, we live in an interesting time, Stephen. I don't know if you had a chance to catch any of the gun violence working group in Minnesota, their hearing yesterday.
Yes.
I noted like one of the common themes for the Democrats or the DFL senators on that panel and providing testimony, there are more guns than people in the United States. Now, if you have a problem with that, then presumably you want to get to a point where we have more people than guns, which means taking guns away from people who currently own them. There was another senator who talked about, you know, law-abiding gun owners are only law-abiding until they commit a crime. So I think the mask is maybe starting to slip a little bit. And it's not just that, you know, these gun control activists have a problem with unlawful use of firearms. They have a problem with gun ownership in general, as we've known in many cases. But I think they're making it more and more clear that that actually is the case.
I mean, certainly some of them do, right? But I think it does go back to the point you were just making about one of the problems with trying to ban concealed carry somewhere in favor of open carry would just be that not everyone wants to ban gun carry generally. And it's the same problem here, where it's like there's certainly a faction, a significant portion of the gun control movement that would like to see a great reduction in the number of firearms overall. March for Our Lives has put out a plan a couple of years ago that called for a 30% reduction, for instance, in the number of civilian firearms in the country. So it is an explicit goal of some people. But, you know, I think it does go back to what you were talking about, that not all Democrats feel that way about guns. They by and large, as a party, want more gun restrictions, certainly, but the more aggressive push to confiscate firearms or to ban gun carry, or, you know, trying to do something where ban the most popular version of gun carry, would get internal resistance as well. And I think Minnesota is probably a good example of that, because I think we already know the math there is not in the favor of something like an assault weapons ban. Now, it's primarily because of the legislature being closely divided and Republicans not wanting to support it. To be fair, it's not primarily because of Democratic resistance, but they also see the political realities of trying to pass something like this. And even in a state that is pretty blue, like you look at the presidential election, certainly Minnesota goes for Democrats pretty consistently. Mm-hmm. You're still going to have something like an assault weapons ban be a really tall order to get past, even in the wake of a horrible shooting like we saw at Annunciation school. So,
yeah. I think the margins are closer in Minnesota than we would like. I mean, I was talking mm-hmm. with Brian Strausser about this last week, and there are two rural Senate Democrats who, you know, have either come out in opposition or who have, you know, kind of made it known behind the scenes that they would not support something like this. Without those two, you know, they may very well have had the votes if you could get one Republican to cross over, right? But to your point as well, we were talking with Rick Travis from CRPA yesterday about the Glock ban bill that passed in California. And, you know, he said he's used to seeing bills like this pass, you know, 80 to 10, 70 to 20. And he said, I think this one, I want to say it had 46 votes, maybe. Like he said, the margin was much closer. There actually were a significant number of Democrats, not enough to kill the bill, but a significant number of Democrats who voted against the Glock ban bill in California, even after it had been amended to supposedly allow for a way to, you know, change the design of these firearms and continue to be sold in the state. So your broader point is right, right? As you get more to the margins of what gun control activists are pushing, support even among, you know, Democrat politicians tends to fade away, right?
Not as much as gun rights activists would like to see.
Obviously. Right. And not always to the point that we can defeat these bills, but again, the margins become closer. And you can look at, you know, Colorado and the permit to purchase ban, or what started out, complete ban on semi-automatic firearms, right? The Democrat-controlled legislature wasn't going to go along with that, so they amended it and basically turned it into a permit to purchase, and then it narrowly passed the legislature.
And I would say, too, that that's also this is probably the effect in the Glock ban as well, is the courts having an effect, is too. Like, you know, it's an interplay between the courts and the politics of these issues. Where, you know, if there was no question about the legality of an assault weapons ban, if there's no question about the legality of this Glock ban in California, you'd probably have more Democrats on board with it. But the reality is the assault weapons bans, I think most people believe, are not long for this world as far as Supreme Court action goes. It's not a sure thing, but I think that's where most people would view the court coming down. that they're likely not going to stand. And so in Colorado, that leads to some additional opposition politically, because why are we doing these things that are going to get struck down? You know, some people are willing to do it as a messaging thing, right? But not everyone, and especially not people who are from, you know, more competitive areas in the state, right? As far as the elections go. And so, you know, at a certain point, you keep passing gun laws that keep getting struck down. So there might be some political fatigue to that. And you might want to try and come up with things that are less restrictive, but constitutional, right? And that's what I think happened with the Colorado bill, and why I think you could see it repeated elsewhere, including in Minnesota, with this upcoming session. We don't know exactly what they're going to be voting on yet, or what Walz is going to support.
Right.
And then maybe even, you know, you could look ahead at Virginia, for instance, depending on how this election goes, I could see something like that coming here to where we live in Virginia, the Colorado style permit to purchase bill, instead of, because they tried an assault weapons ban in Virginia years back when Democrats had full control, and it failed for the same reason that we're talking about here. There were a few Democrats, while they were willing to do universal background checks and red flag laws, weren't willing to go all the way on an assault weapons ban. And so it failed. But when they come back again, maybe something closer to the Colorado bill will have more success. You know, we don't know, obviously. It's just where I could see things going.
Yeah, I mean, talk about Virginia specifically. I'm concerned that if Abigail Spanberger is the next governor, that's likely going to mean a Democrat trifecta, right? So mm-hmm. You'll have the governor, you'll have both chambers of the legislature. And, you know, one of the, again, there were, back then, there were a couple of Senate Democrats who balked. One of them was Cray Deeds, mm-hmm. who ended up sponsoring a ban on so-called assault weapons last session, right? So I think yeah. most of the Democrats in Virginia, unfortunately, even the few that, you know, balked the first time around, I think they're now on board. And I think you're right that a permit to purchase is going to be the backup plan if, you know, so-called assault bans are struck down by the Supreme Court. That will be the next step for what gun control activists do. They'll try mm-hmm. to impose, you know, specific restrictions on the purchase of those and possession of those firearms. And we'll have to go through this litigation all over again. But I think that, you know, we saw this in Rhode Island this year. I think there are some states that you're right, like Colorado. I think that there maybe was some hesitation on the part of Democrats about, you know, going too far, either paying a political price or being overturned by the courts. But I think when the Supreme Court turned down Snope, I mean, I think that gave the green light to, you know, some other blue states like Rhode Island to say, well, let's go ahead and move ahead with a ban on, you know, these firearms, because the Supreme Court had the opportunity to take up a case, tell us we couldn't do it, and they didn't do it. So I think until the Supreme Court steps in, it's still going to be the primary goal and the primary agenda to actually ban these firearms outright.
Yeah.
And then when they are told they can't do that, or again, if the state is, you know, so closely divided that these politicians are worried about paying the price of the polls, yeah, that's when they'll fall back on that, you know, that sort of intermediate step of, okay, you can keep them, you can buy them, but we're going to make sure you jump through all these extra hoops and hurdles to exercise your right to own an AR-15.
Yeah, I think that's fair analysis, right? It could go either way in Virginia, to my view. Certainly Democrats have had control of the lower house here for the Senate, right, for a little while, and they have passed a bunch of gun control bills, including, I believe, an assault weapons ban. Yeah. Most recently. So, you know, it sort of depends on what you think. If they passed a whole slew of gun control bills through the body that they control, but through both houses of the legislature are Democratic controlled right now.
Yeah, because I think Youngkin vetoed like 20-something bills this year.
Right. And so you could look at that package as this is what they're going to do if Democrats get full control of the state government, or you could look at it as this is something they're willing to do because they don't have full control and they might be more cautious if and when they get it. And I think either view is fair. Like, it's not outlandish just to look at it either way. And you're right, though. Like, certainly you're not going to see, for instance, states that already have assault weapons bans are not going to repeal them and go to a Colorado style permit to purchase law. But it could be that in a state like Virginia or some of these other more purple states, or light blue states, or whatever you want to call them. This is sort of the alternative that's up, and it'll probably be the alternative if and when the Supreme Court strikes down those weapons bans, as you said.
Yeah, I think it's I think you're spot on with that. Stephen, again, I appreciate you coming on the program. I would encourage folks, if you are not already a member of The Reload, you need to subscribe. There is all kinds of fantastic reporting, great analysis, both from Stephen and Jake Fogelman. And you've got another writer on staff now too, right?
Well, we had Ben Owen. He was our intern.
Your intern, okay.
National Journalism Center, so he's back at school now. But, you know, we're always trying to get guest writers in too. And, you know, we're trying to keep the analysis and reporting flowing as much as we possibly can.
And then, of course, the Weekly Reload podcast as well. You should sign up and make sure that you are getting that and listening to that every week. Stephen, again, man, really appreciate your time. Hope we get a chance to do this again soon. And if the Sox don't make it to the playoffs, I'll be rooting for the Phillies. I'm going to adopt your team this fall for a few weeks. Bills.
Thank you.
All right, man, we'll talk to you soon.
All right, see you.
My thanks to Stephen for coming on the program. I think a fascinating conversation. I'm not an attorney, so what I have to say carries no legal weight whatsoever. But to me, the fact that the plain text of the Second Amendment did not designate a specific form of bearing arms, it says we've got the right to keep, we've got the right to bear, that to me, the easiest explanation is that, okay, well, that protects both open and concealed carry. But again, I'm not an attorney, so no legal weight whatsoever to that opinion. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. This is an odd one. Here's the headline from CBS in Los Angeles. San Francisco police arrest Bay Area chef as suspect in 3 bank robberies. 62-year-old Valentino Lucian was identified and arrested in connection with 3 bank robberies that happened all the same day, September 10th. So it didn't take long for police to put 2 and 2 together here, apparently. Now, what's interesting about this case is that Lucian pleaded guilty in 2018 to robbing another bank in California. Now they say that, again, 3 robberies within the span of just a few hours. One at just after noon on September the 10th, a man entered a business, passed a note to an employee demanding money, then left the area. 2 other banks robbed in the Central District of San Francisco that day, all with sort of the same MO, or at least similar MOs. Police said they were able to identify Lucian as a suspect, that he was arrested on suspicion of robbery, attempted robbery, and second-degree robbery. Now, in 2018, the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Office said that Lucian had walked into a Citibank. He was wearing gloves and sunglasses. He pointed a gun at a teller and then demanded large bills. According to the Sheriff's Office, he was able to get away with about $18,000 before he was arrested at his home. He ended up taking a guilty plea in 2018 to second-degree robbery. And he got 1 year in the county jail and 3 years of probation. Now, 1 year in the county jail does not actually amount to 1 year in the county jail, particularly not in California. You're looking closer to like 4 months in the county jail for armed robbery, which, I mean, again, this is California. Maybe I shouldn't be surprised by that, but all kinds of gun laws aimed at you and I, right? And yet somebody walks into a bank, points a gun at a teller, gets away with $18,000, at least for a little while, and then ultimately gets away with the crime with just a slap on the wrist. So I will say, I mean, obviously you're innocent until proven guilty. Courts have not proved that Valentino Lucian was responsible for these 3 bank robberies. But if he was, can you really be surprised, given the light sentence that he received the first time he robbed a bank? I mean, again, actions have consequences. And when the state's response, when they act in such a lackadaisical manner to a serious crime, we should not be surprised when criminals decide, you know what, I think I can get away with it. And even if I can't, what's really going to happen to me? All right, today's Armed Citizen story, also from California, the Bay Area as well. A suspect smashed front of Milpitas jewelry store before being scared off by the owner. You know, it was a couple of days ago, we talked about an armed robbery in East Oakland, California, at a pawn shop. 5 against 1. 5 armed robbers come into this building. The pawn shop owner has a gun of his own. He ended up killing two of his assailants, wounding the three others. Now, in this case, it doesn't look like any of the suspects were injured, but this was a much larger group. It wasn't just five individuals. Here's a still of that security video. And it's about, I think police said it was about 15 individuals there in Milpitas. Happened 1:30 in the afternoon last Wednesday. And after the store owner fired a single shot, all of these suspects took off. So once again, the presence of an armed citizen. Now, you could argue this didn't, the fact that there was an armed store owner, that didn't prevent the crime from happening, right? I mean, there was a robbery attempt, but it stopped the crime from escalating. It stopped these individuals from being able to actually break into that jewelry store, being able to assault the store owner, being able to take off with the, you know, the stock there in the store that provides this owner his livelihood. So, yes, I would call this a very successful defensive gun use. What was fascinating about this story in particular is that ABC7 in San Francisco talked with the mayor of Milpitas, Carmen Montano. And she said, quote, "I feel if they didn't have that weapon to scare them off, it would have been worse." Now, I don't think this was, I mean, maybe the store owner would disagree. It doesn't sound to me like this was an attempt to scare off the robbers. This was an attempt to defend against these robbers. Montano also said the business was hit by robbers 2 years ago. She said this is not the first time. They were already robbed. The first time was really bad. All their merchandise was stolen, and the insurance company raised their rates. It's a domino effect, multiplier effect, and this time she said she's done. So, excuse me, I was incorrect in referring to the store owner as a man. This was apparently a woman who owned this jewelry store. Montano, again, saying if she didn't have a gun, this would have been worse, is not something that I expect to hear from a Bay Area mayor. I expect to hear the opposite. I mean, you talk to me about the Bay Area, California. The mayor commented on this. I'm thinking, oh, geez, what'd they say? She would have been better off if she didn't have a gun. You know, just get a good ID, get a good description of the suspects. So I am very pleased that Carmen Montano actually recognized the value of gun ownership here in preventing this robbery. And perhaps preventing the loss of life as well. So thank you again to Mayor Montano. She has actually spearheaded a movement of Bay Area mayors to write a group letter to Governor Gavin Newsom to allocate funding for Prop 36. That was that crime bill. She says it's getting out of hand. We've got to step up. If it's getting out of hand, we've got to step up and please do your job. I hope that Mayor Montana will actually maybe include a request to Governor Newsom to veto all of the gun control bills that are headed his way and to start recognizing our Second Amendment rights instead of cosplaying as a Second Amendment supporter. Finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. We'll stay on the West Coast, but we'll leave the state of California for this one. Attendees saved man who had a heart attack during Spokane comedy show. And I guess that's a sign that you're a pretty good comedian, right? When someone is you laugh themselves into a heart attack. Drew Lynch was the comedian in question. He was performing last Friday night, and in his early show, about 10 minutes into a set, guy in the audience just collapses, had a cardiac event right there. Lynch said, "I got to experience a group of people coming together to revive someone, to give them back their life." He said it was a beautiful thing because it restored hope for whatever's going on in this crazy world. He said it felt like forever to understand what was going on. But once he did, he asked, you know, let's raise the house lights. People can see what's going on. People in the room, he said, with no ego, cleared a path to the gentleman. They worked together to save the man's life. There was actually a group of nurses who were at a table behind the guy who had a heart attack. and they started performing chest compressions until paramedics arrived. According to Lynch, the man had no pulse for 5 minutes. He said it was a miracle that he survived. He's never seen anything like it. But he said, Spokane, you should be very proud. People on Facebook also praising Lynch for his calm reaction, which again included turning up the house lights so that folks could see what was going on. The EMTs had room to get to that individual. They said that Lynch addressed the crowd and spoke from the heart to keep people at ease afterwards. And then the next day, Lynch and the comedian who was opening for him, Rachel Aljefe, I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly, actually went to the hospital and spoke to the guy. Aljefe said, simply could not be a cooler guy. Said, I was so relieved to see him surrounded by family and in such good spirits. He was joking with us, asking us Comedy Insider questions, telling us all about his work as a speech therapist in school. So, again, in the right place, at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. It sounds like so many people there at that comedy show in Spokane, Washington, able to save the life of a stranger by coming together and doing what needed to be done. So, yeah, Drew Lynch, those nurses, everybody in the crowd, I thank you all for your very, very good deed. Now, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program, as always. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day today. We are keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information, including what is going on with open carry down in Florida. Also, a new lawsuit filed in Washington, this time not by the good guys. No. The anti-gun politicians, once again, going after Glock, and now Glock sellers. Not just the gun company itself. So we've got that for you at Bearing Arms as well. We'll see you back here tomorrow for the Wednesday edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.